We're getting close to the end of the month, and September has been the month over the last 16 years when this community has shared a read. We call it One Read. And we have covered all types of books, fiction and nonfiction. Some of them have been science fiction. Others have been realistic. You can go online at One Read at the Daniel Boone Regional Library, and you can find out what the books have been. And this year's been a really good one, The Turner House, which is a novel that has won all kinds of awards, been recognized in so many ways. It was a finalist for the National Book Award, and the author is Angela Flournoy, and she's coming to visit Columbia. I believe she'll be here tomorrow for a presentation at Columbia College tomorrow evening, but we're lucky to have her on the phone to talk to us this morning. Nice to meet you this way. Good morning. How are you?
Hello. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Now, tell me, first of all, I've liked to ask over the years when we've had the author of our One Read selection, I've always liked to ask the reaction that the author has had when he or she has found out that this community is going to read her or his book. What was your reaction?
Oh, it was utter delight. I have been to Missouri. I've never been to your community, but I am always happy to have my book read by anyone, particularly in the Midwest. I was fortunate enough to be the One Read before for Seattle, but it's just a different kind of experience when there's certain things in the book that I think resonate kind of organically with the Midwest audience in a way that it doesn't really as much other places.
You know what? That's an interesting observation, because I would agree with you. I'm not quite sure how the people in Seattle would respond, but here in Missouri, especially thinking of the Midwest, and even because in your book you have characters that they make a reference to the fact of Missouri as being one of the places where one of them spent some time.
Yeah, there's all sorts of kind of movement in the background around the Midwest. And Layla, one of the main characters, did indeed spend some years in her early 20s in Missouri.
And, of course, the families, the mother and dad came, for those who haven't read it or have read it, they remember them coming from Arkansas. You wrote this book. When did you finish this book and say, I'm done with this, it's off to the publisher now, and they're going to print these books, I don't know how it's going to do, but I have finished now writing The Turner House? When was that?
Oh, you mean when they had to pry it away from me? They didn't want me to work on it anymore. That was, I think, in July of 2014. I started the book in 2010, and that was when I had no more time to tinker around with it. It was over. I had to let go. That was in 2014.
So that was 3 years, a little over 3 years ago. Before I make any other comment about that, you have just revealed something about you as a writer. So you're one of those kinds of writers where you would continue to nourish and to nitpick. I don't know whether you want to be positive or negative. It depends on probably whether it's your editor or your publisher saying, are you done with this or can we move on with this? You're one of those kinds of writers.
I hope that I won't be forever, but especially this book. It was my first book, and in some ways it was a book that I had to teach myself how to write this book. So it was kind of just when I was getting good, when I had figured out what I was doing, is when it was time to let the book go. So I think it was also about kind of trying to hang on to a comfort area that I had created for myself.
What do you mean you had to teach yourself how to write this book?
I'd never written a novel before. I had started one and gotten about 70 pages in, and then it didn't seem like it had any more steam. But I had never written third person, so not like a first person, a character with an eye telling a story, but like a big omniscient narrator who knows everything. I'd never written something like that. I'd never written something with a huge cast of characters. I really did kind of just in a series of trial and error fumble my way through this. And so it was something that once I thought I had figured out how to do it, it was really difficult for me to let go of that.
Angela Flournoy is our guest, listening to her talk about the writing process behind The Turner House, her first novel, which was a terrific one. And in the book review that came out, it's been a couple of years since they reviewed this in the New York Times, but the very first line says, in The Turner House, an engrossing and remarkably mature first novel by Angela Flournoy, Detroit has been hit hard by the crisis in the auto industry. We can talk about some of the details of the story here in a moment, but as far as a first novel is concerned, when the review in the New York Times says a remarkably mature first novel, I don't know whether you have reflected on the maturity level of what comes out in this novel or not, but I think that it is apparent to any of us who've read that they're exactly right. Your reaction to that, please.
Oh, that's a wonderful compliment for me. My mother has been telling me my whole life that I'm an old woman trapped in a young person's body. But I really tried to take seriously my characters, and I didn't try to kind of alter reality because I thought that perhaps readers weren't interested in middle-aged people or people in their 60s. I just wrote the characters at the age they would have realistically been in the present day of the book and built the world around that. And a lot of people have noted that that was something that's unusual for someone to do when the book came out. I had just turned 30. But for me, those were the characters. And so you go where the characters are. I wasn't going to kind of change it from a family story into some sort of teenage romance because mm-hmm. that's closer to me in age. It didn't seem like that would make any sense.
I thought what you said, and I read another interview that you had done when I saw the printed script of another interview that you did. You wanted to write about regular people. I think, though, that if I'm asking an author to, say, write about regular people, it seems like a reader would say, well, I don't want to read about regular people. But your book proves that that is not true. I think others prove that also, but we do want to read about regular people. You hope what? That we see ourselves in some of these people?
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in trying to figure out ways to highlight the extraordinary and the ordinary. I think a lot of us kind of go through every day thinking that our lives are not very noteworthy and that we're maybe boring. And some of us take pride in that. I take pride in being a little boring. But there are things, I think, that has to do with probably pop culture and television and the way that we're kind of trained to think that in order to be extraordinary, you've got to be, you know, Peter Parker and you're Spider-Man or something. When really to be extraordinary is just, there's so many small moments that happen in one's life where you make decisions that change the course of not just your life, but all these people's around you lives. And those are things that to me are kind of extraordinary. Or that you just decide to forgive a person or you decide to sacrifice something for someone. Those are things that nobody has to do. And every time those things happen to me, I find them really interesting and magical.
The other thing that I've thought, and just in hearing what you just said, you might decide to forgive a person. You might just decide that it's best just to live with something. And I think that that is what happens in several examples in the Turner House. You just kind of decide, you know what, it's best just to live with this.
Right. And that is something that it was not so much about settling, but it's about figuring out what are the things that you're going to allow to kind of derail your own sense of contentment and happiness. And so some of the things in the book, they're not in their control, but they're also things that if they sat back and looked at them are not actually causing them any harm. So for instance, character Cha-Cha has this paint or a ghost that paint is the language that he grew up hearing. So that's what he calls it in the book. But he has this spirit, this supernatural vision or presence, and it bothers him. And it's not really until he kind of has to sit back and think about why exactly it's bothering him that he realizes that perhaps he's been giving it too much power.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions that you refuse to answer and you say that as far as the haint is concerned, and you would say, I'm sorry, listener or a reader, you're just going to have to figure that out for yourself. So if I were to ask you, explain that haint to me. Tell me exactly what that haint is, what it's representative of, and answer my question and give me the specific details about that. Would you say, okay, I'll do that, or would you say, well, you know what, that's part of the experience of reading. You kind of have to leave those unanswered by the author.
I've done both. And I find that people are not satisfied, whether I say I'm not going to say anything or if I try to, people are not really satisfied. Because the thing is, the haint is not, there's not just one answer. That is the most frustrating to high schoolers and junior high schoolers because they want to know what to put in their essay. And so when I talk to them, they're like, I need a thesis sentence so that I can write an essay about your book. But it's not most fiction. As readers, we come away and we can identify all of these themes and these symbols and these through lines. But for writers, we don't necessarily always think that concretely about it. Sometimes on revision, we can see things we've done that are kind of all pointing towards one thing. But other times, they're these kind of miraculous like occurrences that keep popping up in the fiction, and you didn't mean for it to be that way. And in this case, the haint is really not just doing one thing. It's not like there's one thing that happened bad or something in Cha-Cha's past, and now he's being haunted. It really is a reflection of, one, his own kind of preoccupation with his life, like where he is in his life and how he grew up. And also the like what sort of things has he inherited from his parents. So I don't, without sort of giving it away for any of your readers who haven't read the book yet, or your listeners rather, who haven't read the book yet, The Hang is, it's about, it's really about where Cha-Cha is in his life.
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity for him to make choices about how he wants to live the remainder of his life.
Angela Flournoy is our guest again. We're talking about the Turner House, which is our one read selection for the community. And she will be speaking tomorrow at Lanner Auditorium, Columbia College. So much that it's, I've noted so many things. And then you said something that I wanted to track down now, because you mentioned that high schoolers, did you say middle schoolers also? Sometimes.
There have been middle schoolers who have come to my readings. The youngest person who has read this book was 9 years old, which was a surprise, but she seemed very mature, much like myself. So.
Oh, why? I would say a 9-year-old reading this book, that kind of is a surprise to me. I would like to compare, it would be fun to compare the reaction of a high schooler, a mature high schooler, to this book, to my own. I'm 60-plus years old, and as I read this, I find Cha-Cha to be, I'm thinking, I'm about his age, but I don't feel as old as he does. I feel like he seems older than I am, and I would be interested to know what a reaction of a teenager, a late teenager, would be to his relationship with his therapist and to his overall position as a father figure to his younger brothers and sisters in this large family. Have they shared their thoughts to you that surprised you at all and how they interpreted these kinds of relationships?
They are, a lot of the young people, a lot of the high schoolers that I've spoken to about the book are really interested in the sibling dynamics, because it's something I think that is more immediate to them, because most of them, you know, they live with their siblings still. So they are interested in the sibling dynamics, and they're interested in the idea of some of those ways that your identity is cemented in your sibling's eyes when you are an adolescent. It's very hard, even 20, 30 years later, to get them to see you as someone else. And that is something they find interesting, because I think a lot of them are not actively thinking about how is my behavior now, how is that potentially going to influence my behavior or my relationship with my siblings later. And it shouldn't, of course, but you know, it's just sort of the way people are, especially if you move away and you don't have constant contact with them. When you are together again, it's like time kind of freezes.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that's really, it can be really fun and nostalgic, or it can be really frustrating.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. In a situation just a few weeks ago, my only aunt passed away and she had 4 children. My first cousins, the only first cousins I have, hadn't seen some of them in 30 years, maybe even beyond 30 years, maybe 40 years. And when we got together, it was hard for me not to imagine them as they would have been when they were junior high and high school age children. So you're exactly right. We get locked in and frozen into that. I want to talk about your research. You mentioned research a moment ago. How about we have a listener, and she may be listening today, who lived in Detroit 50 years ago when the riots broke out. I read something that you said, and then in the book also, you don't refer to them much as a riot. Address how you chose to address the unrest in Detroit in 1967 as a part of this book story.
Well, at first I had no intention to include those days in 1967, because I thought they're just too big. There's already been so much sort of written about them, and they are one of those things that it reminds me of a movie I enjoyed. I never read the book, but Forrest Gump, right? But that's sort of the special thing about him, is that he's always right there when like these big historical moments are happening. But I didn't necessarily want that to be my characters, that are just sort of always at the right place at the right moment when these big historical things are happening. But I also thought that those kinds of events, whether it is in Detroit, whether it is 1967 unrest or uprising or whatever you want to call it, or if it's other events, those are things that even 20, 40 years later, they seem like turning points, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both for the city itself, but for individual people. And it seems like it would be doing my characters a disservice to try to skip over that period of time. And as far as the vocabulary I decided to use, that was also something that was an outcropping of research. And I really, even though it's, you know, I'm the narrator in certain senses, and I'm kind of the the final say on what happens in the book on a language level, I did want to be cognizant and respectful to the all of the people, both people who lived during that period of time, and I listened to and read a lot of oral histories, but also all of the scholarship that points to a more nuanced understanding of why those days happened in 1967, and not to just put a fine point on it and not to kind of pick a side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that kind of in retrospect, both in 1967 in Detroit, and I'm from Los Angeles, so 1965 in Watts, mm-hmm. in retrospect, a lot of people are being a little bit more understanding of why those things happened and how a riot sometimes makes it seem like it was just a ball of chaos and anger and not a attempt to get some sort of redress for significant grievances.
Uh-huh. Let's move on to research you did. How did you do research as far as the family research and the dynamics of family? Was that from personal experience or research? And then also, I'll tack on another question just so I can get two in for the price of one here. When you did the Alice character, who was the psychotherapist for Cha-Cha that he visited and had an affection for, have you received feedback from those who are in that profession who would say to you, oh, you got that right, or why did you do this to us? Either reaction?
So first, research in general, I basically just read a lot of books about Detroit, and one thing that I started to hone in on more and more was what were the experiences of the African-American community who migrated there from the South, because in a lot of ways, both just on a city planning level, but on a political level, the arrival of those migrants from the South to the North to Detroit really changed the makeup of the city in a lot of ways, led to the Detroit we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read a lot of books about those early years and what kind of obstacles they faced and also what sort of gains they made. And I thought that I wasn't going to do anything actually on the page with all that information. But then more and more, I thought I need to figure out a way to include it, which is how those sections in the 40s with Francis as a newcomer to the city came to be. And as far as Alice, so I actually haven't, you know, in general, I'm very surprised that no one has stood up in the middle of a reading and just said, like, you're wrong. You got it all wrong about anything, because there were so many things in this book that I had to kind of wing it. Like, I did the research, and then the thing is there's a distance between research and figuring out a way how to live inside a character.
Mm.
Because as soon as you can figure out what is the best practice, you know, for, say, a mental health professional, but then it's like, well, what if this character has this agenda, though? How does this manifest itself?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when things get dicey. And so I really did try to make it like this is an individual, not a referendum on the entire profession.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be why I haven't had anyone kind of confront me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Alice even becomes aware of her own kind of professional shortcomings, which is why, you know, she kind of changes course. And so I tried to make it seem like this is not necessarily something that is happening all of the time. Anytime someone, you know, sits in a chair
to
a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Angela Flournoy is our guest for just a few more moments. The Turner House is the book, and she's going to be at Lahner Auditorium, Columbia College, tomorrow, 7 o'clock, to kind of give the, it is the high point for many of us who have been involved in the One Read program. I like books when they're not only showing you, like, forward progress of the movement and the characters and in the plot line, but I like them which make me stop and write down something. And I wrote down late in the book on page 295, Layla is talking about something, and she says, now back at this place, Layla saw it had cost too much to aim for so little. Those are great lines. I don't expect you to remember the inspiration for writing that line or anything like that, but when those just come out, it costs too much to aim for so little. Those are some of those that strike us, and you start all of a sudden to say, well, what about my life? Did it cost too much to aim for so little? Those are good little thoughts that you throw in there. That I just want to compliment you on that. I don't know if you have any response to those kinds of additions to the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Those are, I don't know where those come from.
Yeah.
I consider those gifts. Sometimes I think that I'm trying to be too philosophical and I'll pull back on them, and other times I let them stay. So I let that one stay, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I'm glad you let it stay also, because it gives us things to think about. I'm going to let you go in a couple of moments. I got just a couple more questions for you. One, deeply in regard to the book, and then I'm going to diverge from the book, if I may, and you may want to end the conversation right then. But my question about the book is, 3 years ago in July, you said that you finally ran out of time. They said, enough. You're not going to work on this book anymore. We want it now. Here we are talking about it 3+ years later. You ever get tired of the Turner House?
No. I'm very fortunate in that way. I know people who have gotten tired of talking about their book. I really haven't, and I think that's one of the benefits of putting a whole bunch of stuff in your book, is that you can have a lot of different conversations, you know, just depending on what the person kind of resonated with, what the reader resonated with. Every day that if anyone asks me about my book, I just feel so fortunate. So, no, I am not tired of it.
Then I want to refer to something that I came across, because as I was preparing, I was looking for other things that you had written, and I know that you do a lot. Last day of last year, it's dated December 31st, 2016. What does it mean to acknowledge the past? In light of having read your book, I thought that was, well, you know what? She acknowledged the past of this family, where it was in the present and where it might go in the future. So I understood the importance of that. You had a comment in that particular essay, though, that was read in his opinion in the New York Times on the final day of 2016, and you said, and I quote, "When my mother and I returned home in the fall, we discovered a United States newly interested in the way we begin our own public events, incited by the football player Colin Kaepernick's decision to kneel during the national anthem in protest of police brutality toward African Americans. He was a hero or an idiot, an opportunist or an activist, depending on whom you asked." That's kind of interesting in light of what has happened since that day in December and how it is still very much in the current headlines today. When you talk about acknowledging the past and referring to that, do you have any thoughts that you would add to those that you shared back then?
Well, back then the op-ed was really about perhaps thinking of other ways to begin our like public events. Mm-hmm. So we began our public events with, it's actually not clear, and I've read all of these various perhaps histories about why it's the national anthem that begins these professional sporting events. But in other countries, they have other ways that they begin events, mm-hmm. and some of them have to do with, you know, acknowledging the history of like the land that they're actually on. And so I had just come from Australia, and so they acknowledge like the original custodians of the land, like the indigenous people who used to basically live there before before colonization. And mm-hmm. so that was one idea I had. But so it's kind of two separate things. One is about like what rituals do we kind of hold dear and why, and then how do they get connected to other things? The idea that the national anthem is inextricably tied to armed, you know, our servicemen is sort of one idea, but it's not perhaps the only idea of why the national anthem is attached to those events. And so it's just something to think about. As far as Kaepernick himself, I would say that I think that he is a person who had individual principles and was punished way more than I think was necessary for exercising his right to express those principles.
Yeah, and we're still we're still fishing in that pond right now, and it's just became a very roiled pond because of what happened on Friday night when the president was speaking. Well, I appreciate you explaining what that essay was about. I got that also, and I thought that was a good essay also, talking about how other places deal with their past in announcements at the beginning of certain events. We are very fortunate to be able to welcome you to Columbia tomorrow for your presentation about the Turner House. I hope a lot of people will be there to hear you. 7 o'clock at Lahner Auditorium, Columbia College. It'll be one of the high points of the One Read program this year. It's been a good one. The Turner House, the novel by Angela Flournoy. Thank you very much for all your time today.
Thank you, David.
It's News Talk 1400 KFRU.